In the 10th chapter of the book of Genesis, we come to a phrase that we've encountered before a number of times. These are the generations. It's a phrase that is used as a marker by Moses in the book of Genesis to indicate a change, a new scene, as it were, the curtains of the drama opening up to a new set and a new episode in the unfolding history that he is recording. It's a phrase that he has applied not only in terms of genealogies of men, as we have it to some degree here in the 10th chapter, but he applies it to other things as well. Early on in the book, these are the generations of the heaven and the earth. In this section, which runs from verse 1 of chapter 10 through to verse 9 of chapter 11, we have two episodes, or at least two descriptions for us. In the first part, chapter 10, we have the beginning of nations presented to us, and closely related to that in the 11th chapter, and verses 1 through 9, the beginnings of languages, which we will look at particularly next time. So here we have a new section, as it were, following on from the long account from the story of the flood, which began in chapter 6 and verse 9. These are the generations of Noah, and flowed through to the end of chapter 9. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Here we're given a global view of the world with a specific focus. In chapter 9 and verse 19, we were told that the sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole of the people of the whole earth were dispersed. Genesis re-emphasizes the fact that all the nations of the earth have descended from Noah through his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. We have a global view then, but it does have a specific function, a specific focus rather. Moses has a story to tell. And the story is not about every nation of the earth. He is moving very specifically and particularly to focus upon one nation of the earth. And this 10th chapter of the book of Genesis actually demonstrates that narrowing focus to us, and indeed that will continue to be the case as we work through this book of Genesis. Well, here are the three sons of Noah: Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And first of all, Moses tells us of the sons of Japheth. And we have this list of names, most of which are unpronounceable to us, as you have already realized. Among the sons of Japheth, we need to make particular note of Gomer. The reason for that is that Gomer is the ancestor of the nation from which the Welsh derived. So we need to acknowledge that. Thank you to Philip Eveson for pointing that out. Anyway, that aside, in this section with regard to Japheth, we have a couple of phrases that are important for us. You cast your mind back to our last study at the end of chapter 9, and we observed that Canaan, the grandson of Noah, was particularly cursed on account of his father's sin. And we're not going to repeat what we concluded there in terms of the nature of Ham being passed on to his son Canaan, which would be exhibited later in history. But on the opposite side of the curse, there was also blessing. Blessing particularly that would accrue to Shem in his allegiance to the covenant God, but a blessing that would overflow to Japheth. And that particularly the blessing upon Japheth would be seen in God enlarging him. And so this appears to be true in these names of descendants that are mentioned here. We have the beginnings of nations that would form, from Moses' perspective, the outer fringes of the world in his day. Now, I had thought that it would be a nice thing to put up on the screen a map and be able to shade where these that the descendants of Japheth moved in this direction and the descendants in Ham in this direction, Shem in that direction. But it's not quite as neat and tidy as that, so I haven't bothered. They were, in fact, scattered around a bit, and there was some intermingling to some degree. Perhaps you've got a Bible that shows a map that has those details in. My Bible doesn't, but there are such maps available. But it's not a neat and a tidy thing like that. But to a large degree, the outer fringes of the world were the nations that came from Japheth. That was from Moses' perspective as he wrote this. But notice a couple of phrases that are used here. We're told that in verse 5, from these the coastland people spread in their lands, each with his own language, by their clans, in their nations. Now, this coastland peoples is an idea, a phrase that repeats in the Old Testament. And indeed, we see the promise given, the blessing given, may God enlarge Japheth, let him dwell in the tents of Shem, being borne out in prophecies that would mention coastland peoples. Let me give you a couple of examples that Philip Evesen points to. In Isaiah and chapter 42 and in verses 1 and 4, we have reference to the coastland peoples. Depending on your translation, it may talk about the isles or nations. Chapter 42 and verse 1 of the book of Isaiah. Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my chosen in whom my soul delights. This is God referring to the Messiah who was to come. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his law. There's a reference then to these peoples, these nations that come from Japheth. And again in the book of Psalms, in Psalm 72 and in verses 10 and 11, we have a reference. May the kings of Tarshish and the coastlands render him tribute. May the kings of Sheba and Seba bring gifts. May all kings fall down before him. All nations serve him. Now this was to some degree fulfilled in the life of Solomon, that wise king, the descendant of David, who brought tribute from the nations, who looked to him as the superpower, really, of their day. But it is more specifically related, of course, again, to the Messiah, and the fact that these nations of the world will find blessing through the Messiah and will devote themselves to the Messiah. There is, therefore, in this language, a reference to the blessing that God has for all the nations of the world, and not just one single and particular nation, though through that particular nation he will bring the blessing about. And so we have the descendants of Japheth mentioned briefly in this chapter. Then we move on to the sons of Ham, and much more space is given to the descendants of Ham from verse 6 through to verse 20. These descendants of Ham, for the most part, are close neighbours to the Israelites. Remember Moses, as he writes this and speaks of these things to the Israelites, they're either wandering in the wilderness or they're encamped in the plains of Moab before they enter into the promised land. Now, that is significant for us in understanding the reason, in part, for Moses penning this. He's giving them the background, their own history, and the reasons why events are going to unfold the way that they do. Why is it that God is dealing with Israel the way that he's dealing with Israel? And why is it that they experience the hostility of their near neighbours as they enter or are on the verge of entering into the promised land? Well, among the sons of Ham are the Canaanites, and I'll mention them a bit more in a moment. But also we have these other sons, Cush, Egypt, Put. These all are near neighbours to Israel and will play a big part in the history, the unfolding history of Israel. Now, we could go through and read all these names again, but I'm not going to do that. But to draw attention to a couple of things in this section. In verse 8, we're told that Cush fathered Nimrod. And some space then is given to this man called Nimrod. He's described as the first on earth to be mighty. And then we're told that he was a mighty hunter. And it was said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and then some other places are mentioned, including Nineveh. Well, some of those names are familiar to us, aren't they? What about this man, Nimrod? Some understand the references to him to be positive. But I think in reality, what we have before us is an explanation or a preparation for what is about to unfold in the early verses of the 11th chapter. It sort of sets the scene for the judgment of God in the 11th chapter. And you may discern then from those comments that I take the references to Nimrod as being in a negative light rather than in a positive light. His name means "we shall rebel" or "let us rebel." Well, there's the first hint, not more everything as well. Doesn't sound particularly positive, does it? Let us rebel. We shall rebel. He was a mighty man. Have you heard that reference before? Well, yes, we have encountered it before. We encountered it before the flood, when we had a description of what the world was like in the opening verses of the 6th chapter of Genesis. Man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them. The sons of God saw the daughters of man, that the daughters of man were attractive. They took as their wives any they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were mighty men who were of old, the men of renown." And if you were with us in our studies back then when we considered those verses, you may recall that what Moses is describing here is a scene of selfishness It's a scene of debauchery. It's a scene of lust and the fulfillment of every evil desire of man's heart. And in the midst then of this scene of evil, of perversion, are the mighty men. They're in the middle of it. They're in the thick of it. They're the leaders of it all. And they make a name for themselves as a result, or in the midst of all of this. Well, here we have then an echo in the life of this man, Nimrod, the one who will rebel. And we're told that he was the first on earth to be a mighty man. Remember, this is the new earth after the flood. This is the new beginning unfolding, but a new beginning, as we saw last time, that still has the same human heart in it. And here we see it gushing up evil from its depths. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. The wickedness and rebellion that was described in chapter 6 is at least hinted at in this phrase ascribed to Nimrod. He is, moreover, a mighty hunter before the Lord, to the extent that there is a proverbial phrase that is used, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. But we mustn't take this in any positive light either. Indeed, the idea being conveyed here is one of a man who stands defiant before the Lord in his corruption. It, again, is something of an echo of chapter 6. Chapter 6 and verse 11. Now, the earth was corrupt in God's sight. Some translations say the earth was corrupt before the Lord. Well, here is a man who was a mighty hunter before the Lord in this corrupt way. Who was the other famous hunter of the book of Genesis? Well, we haven't come to him yet, but you all know the story of Esau and Jacob. You know the story of the man who was strong and successful in his hunting prowess. You know the story of how on occasion he came in from the field having spent a day or a week hunting, and he comes home famished, and he's willing to sell his birthright for a bowl of soup. He wants to satisfy the immediate cravings of his heart. Well, there's Genesis chapter 6 verses 1 through 4 all over again, you see. He takes what he wants when he wants it. He's willing to sell anything at all that seems so insignificant to him at that moment, what seems most desirable to him at that moment. He's a man of selfish ambition. He's a man of corrupt nature. He's a man of a rebellious disposition. And of course then the mention of Babel as the beginning of his kingdom, and of course, though we haven't got to it yet, you all know the story of the Tower of Babel. Well, this is his territory. And here is the man then who determines to build the Tower of Babel. And you see what is motivating then this man. He is a selfish man. He is a man who is rebelling against God. Philip Evesen describes Nimrod as a second Cain. Remember Cain? Yes, he killed his brother Abel, of course. That's, I suppose, the most well-known fact concerning Cain. But you may remember too in chapter 4 how his life and his descendants are described. We're told that that Cain's son Enoch built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad. Irad fathered Mahadiel. Mahadiel fathered Methushael, and he fathered Lamech. And the sons and daughter of Lamech were noted for their incredible natural ability in various things, whether it was agriculture, whether it was technology, not computer technology, but the technology of their day. Instruments of bronze and iron were made. Whether it was the arts, music, or whether it was, in the case of their sister, physical beauty, they excelled in these things. Cain and his descendants were despicable people. They were vile people. And yet, they excelled in these natural abilities. Well, Philip Eveson points out that this is very like Nimrod, who was successful. He was a leader of people. He built great cities. He founded nations. But he was utterly corrupt. Great natural abilities don't signify anything when it comes to good and evil. And so, that is one of the descendants of Ham by his son Cush. But then we come to another of his descendants, and this is a name that we've already considered, Canaan. And the tribes, I guess you would call them, that he fathered are a list of names with which we are very familiar. They come up over and over and over again in the story of the history of Israel. Canaan fathered Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites, and the Girgashites, and the Hivites, and the Arkites, and the Sinites, and the Arvites, and the Zemarites, and the Hamathites, all of these ites. Along with, as one commentator said, termites, evil things that need to be crushed. Well, they were. They were evil things that needed to be crushed, because as the history unfolds, we find that the descendants of Canaan were utterly corrupt. They were sensual, they were degraded, and they were opposed in every way to God and his people. And we find then that as the history of the Israelites unfold, and Abraham is promised their land as his inheritance, one of the reasons that is given for that is as a punishment against the descendants of Canaan, who have become so utterly corrupt that God determines to wipe them off the face of the earth. That is why the children of Israel are told to go into the promised land and not to leave anything alive, man or woman or child or beast. Everything was to be destroyed, because this was a corrupt people who had shaken its fist in the face of God and was coming under the judgment of God. We must read and understand Israel's battles against the Canaanites in light of that reality. And of course, as we move through the book of Genesis, we will see more of that unfolding. And so, Canaan, the cursed grandson of Noah. But notice, and it is important that we notice this, and I commented on it before last time, that it is Canaan particularly who is singled out as cursed. We do have other sons of Ham. There's Cush and Egypt and Put. And some of the descendants of these, though we don't know exactly, as one commentator says, where Put was put, Egypt we know. And the descendants of Cush, we can see their placing in the world and recognize that among their descendants were peoples who would, like the descendants of Japheth, share in the blessings of Shem. And so we come to Shem. Have you noticed that this it's not really a genealogy. It's what is commonly referred to as a table of the nations. But in this, it's all reversed. We would have expected, on the basis that Noah's sons are referred to almost always as Shem, Ham, and Japheth, we would have expected to work through this list in that order. But rather, it's been reversed. We've come to Japheth first, then we've come to Ham, and it's only now that we come to Shem. And of course, the reason for that is that there's a progression to a climax. There's a progression to a climax. Moses is moving this story forward, a global story, as I said earlier, but with a very specific point of focus. He wants our attention to end in a very specific place, not with the descendants of Japheth, who by association will be blessed, but with the descendants of Shem, who very specifically are blessed. Now we have a slight problem, and I'm going to mention it and not resolve it. Verse 21, we're told that to Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the elder brother of Japheth, children were born. Now the problem is this, that some translations don't say the elder brother of Japheth. They say the brother of Japheth, the elder. Is Shem older than Japheth, or is Japheth older than Shem? Well, commentators are divided over which way round it is. We all know that Ham is the youngest because we're explicitly told that in verse 24 of chapter 9. But we cannot state categorically whether Shem is older than Japheth or Japheth older than Shem. The way that this is worded, though, highlights that something different is going on here. You see, we were told in verse 2, the sons of Japheth, and we were given a list. And in verse 6, the sons of Ham, and we're given a list. But in verse 21, we're not told the sons of Shem and given a list. No, Moses wants us to think about this. He's drawing attention to this. To Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the elder brother of Japheth, children were born. And then the sons of Shem. And there they are listed in their usual unpronounceable way. Now, what can we say about these sons of Shem? Well, not a lot about some of them, but one in particular we can focus on, because Moses focuses on him. Moses focuses on him right at the beginning in verse 21. To Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber. Now, when we look further down the list, we realize that Shem is not the direct father of Eber, that rather we have to go through other sons to get to him. But the point is that Eber is descended from Shem, and Eber has a particular significance to the people for whom Moses is writing this book in the first place, the Israelites, on the verge of entering the promised land. Eber is their ancestor. Eber is an ancestor of Abraham. This is the family from which their descent is derived. And so there's a focus here in this table of nations upon this one. And then the sons of Eber. There's a pause, again, a pause on Peleg. To Eber was born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, and his brother's name was Joktan. But in the middle of that, we're told that in his days, that is in Peleg's days, the earth was divided. Peleg meaning division. Now this division of the earth, commentators, a few, say that it's a notable earthquake or something of that nature has taken place. Perhaps a great division of the earth that began the spread of the continents. But it's most likely to be a reference to the timing of the events that are going to be described in a few verses in chapter 11. The events of the Tower of Babel, when the nations, the world, was divided by their languages. And so, to some degree, we're able to pinpoint the period of time in which that great event took place, which we will consider next time. And so Moses sums up this table of nations. These are the clans of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies in their nations. And from these, the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. Philip Eveson points out that as we read through this, and as if we had the time to work through the descendants of these families, these clans, these nations, we would see the population of the whole world spreading and unfolding around the globe. The human race is indeed one family. This is something that the Apostle Paul makes reference to in his sermon recorded for us in Acts chapter 17, where he is standing among the philosophers of the Areopagus in Athens. He says in verse 26 that this God who made the world and everything in it, he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the earth, on the face of all the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. One human family throughout the world, descended from Noah and his three sons. There's no superior race, as different people have argued at various times in history. And even though we may acknowledge that to be true in theory, there are times at which we can, in our own arrogance, think of ourselves as better than others. But this passage gives us no space for that. We are all the same. And as Paul indicates, we all have the same need. The need to be brought right into a right relationship with the God who made us. We are a race, indeed, of Nimrods. And we need the grace of God to change our hearts from its selfish devotion and to make us a people who will devote ourselves to the Creator. Remember, I said that this chapter is a progression towards a climax. And for this chapter, the climax is reached in Shem and his descendants, and particularly with the focus upon Eber. But the ultimate climax has not been reached. No, the story will pick up again after the explanation of of the events of Babel in chapter 11 and verse 10 to talk about Shem and reiterate some of those descendants and to place them in a more genealogical framework and take us then through to Abraham. But of course, we still haven't reached the ultimate climax when we get to Abraham or Isaac or Jacob or David or Solomon, in whose days so many of the references that we find in this chapter are fulfilled. References to curse and blessing. No, Solomon isn't the climax. But rather the story advances steadily and even relentlessly towards that ultimate climax in the person of Jesus Christ. In fact, what we have in this book is a purposeful advance. Moses is telling a story that has an end to it. It has a point to it. And it's not just a point for a people on the verge of entering a land that God has promised to them, but its point is to unfold for all of us the reality of the fulfillment of the promise made in the account of the curse upon Satan, upon the serpent, that the seed of the woman would come, a seed who would crush the head of the serpent, the seed who finds his fulfillment in the person of Jesus Christ. And indeed, this relentless, steady advance towards the climax is seen even in the life of Jesus Christ. We find the expression in the writings of Luke in his Gospel and the 9th chapter. The words that when the days drew near for him, that is Jesus, to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And in Mark's Gospel, we have an interesting repetition of the reality of what would befall Jesus in Jerusalem. We're told in chapters 8, chapters 9, and chapter 10, in slightly different words, what Jesus would face. In terms of his being betrayed, in terms of his being arraigned before a judge, and in terms of his being crucified. Jesus set his face. There was a relentless, steady progression towards a fixed goal. And the goal was the cross of Calvary. Now that relentless progression is already beginning here. In this account of Genesis 10, with all of its complicated names and unknown places, is nevertheless the story of redemption, the story of deliverance from sin, the story of a coming Saviour that the whole world needs. Every nation under heaven needs this Saviour, for there is no other name given among men by which we must be saved. Do you understand the story of the Bible? Do you recognise where Genesis is going? And have you recognised Jesus as the Saviour to which it points?